88.3 Southern FM. The sounds of the Bayside.
Earth below us. Drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Welcome to episode 19 of our Planet Earth series. Now, these programs are a mix of factual reports, sometimes poetry and sometimes some fanciful music, but all of them about our home planet. And we begin with a weather report from Greenland. According to Reuters, rain has fallen at the highest point of the Greenland ice sheet for the first time on record. And this is another worrying sign of warming for the ice sheet, which is already melting at an increasing rate. According to Imrani Das, who is a glaciologist with Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, that's not a healthy sign for an ice sheet. He said that water on ice is bad. It makes the ice sheet more prone to surface melt. Well, the rain fell for several hours at the ice sheet's 2,216-metre-high summit on August the 14th, where temperatures remained above freezing for about 9 hours. Now, temperatures at the ice cap rarely lift above freezing, but have now done so 3 times since 2012. So, things are not looking good for the Greenland ice sheet.
On November the 2nd, 2009, SMOS was launched from the Plesetsk Cosmodrome, on top of a rocket launcher. SMOS is one of ESA's Earth Explorer missions that address key scientific challenges and demonstrate new technology in space. Carrying a novel instrument to return information on soil moisture and ocean salinity, both key components of the Earth's water cycle, SMOS is advancing our knowledge of how water is cycled between the Earth's surface and the atmosphere. Understanding these exchange processes is crucial for understanding climate change, for improving weather prediction, and, for example, helping to optimize water consumption when growing crops.
SMOS measures directly the surface soil moisture. So this is really the kind of rain gauge of the atmosphere. So we collect the rain and we store it. Measuring surface soil moisture gives us a hint on the rainfall, so we can partition the rainfall. But also looking at its evolution, we can link it to different other things. One of them is, of course, dryness or wetness of the soil, so floods or droughts. But also the fact that the impact of other events, such as El Niño or La Niña, and its impact on the rainfall distribution, hence the wetness. So it is used to infer or droughts or monitor the droughts, but also, of course, for food security in many regions, to anticipate crop yield, especially in areas which are limited by rainfall.
This research satellite was originally planned to be in orbit for 5 years, but thanks to Europe's technological excellence, it has already doubled its life in orbit, providing time series data for a variety of applications. For instance, SMOS data is used for ESA's climate change initiative, through which data are compiled to understand how climate variables are changing over time. Its data are also combined with data from other satellites, such as Cryosat, to map the thickness of sea ice, a crucial climate variable.
With SMOS, we have the possibility to measure the sea ice thickness. In particular, the thickness of thin ice we can measure with SMOS. We have also the companion, the ESA Earth Explorer Cryosat. This was specifically designed to measure the sea ice thickness, and Cryosat is great to measure the thickness of thick ice from the freeboard. But with SMOS, we can accurately measure the thin ice.
SMOS data are also used to map the freezing and thawing of soil. This is important because frozen soil, and in particular permafrost, acts as a carbon source. When permafrost thaws, carbon is released back into the atmosphere, amplifying the greenhouse effect. By comparing data over several years, SMOS helps us to better understand variables affected by and affecting climate change. Over the years, SMOS has proven to be a versatile satellite, going way beyond its original scientific goals. Today, SMOS data are even used operationally for weather prediction by organisations such as the European Centre for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts.
SMOS is very important for weather prediction because weather is related to forecast of the atmospheric variables, but it's also related to land surface forecast and ocean forecast, river forecast. And for this, for weather prediction, our strategy is to develop an Earth system approach where we have a consistent forecast for the different components of the Earth system. And in this context, variables which are at the interface between land surface and atmosphere, or ocean and atmosphere, are very important to ensure the consistency across the different Earth system components. And SMOS is exactly that. It is providing information at the interface between the different Earth system components.
Over the course of a decade, SMOS has given the scientific community an unprecedented wealth of data. And while it has long surpassed its intended lifespan, SMOS remains hard at work while new missions are being studied and prepared to ensure continuous data sets with even higher resolutions and improved technology.
Wildfires, bushfires if you will, have been scorching many areas of the Northern Hemisphere in the past 2 months. For example, more than 400,000 hectares of land has been burnt in Northern California. One, the Dixie Fire, is the second largest in history. It has burnt 300,000 hectares. The Terra satellite orbits the Earth at an altitude of 700 kilometres, as it has done since late 1999. One of the instruments aboard is the multi-angle imaging spectroradiometer. This has 9 cameras that view the Earth at different angles. This multiple view has allowed scientists to calculate the height of the smoke plumes. Whilst most of the smoke reached an altitude of 3,000 metres, some was reaching 6,000 metres. The higher smoke goes, the further it travels. In recent weeks, smoke from fires in the western United States and Canada has blanketed much of the east coast of North America. On the Space Show, we're looking at planet Earth.
This is planet Earth. You're looking at planet Earth.
Paul Davies will be known to many Australians because he used to live here for quite a few years. Well, he has this thought on how life on Earth began. Paul Davies.
Earth and Sky.
The question about whether life is a freak accident or built into the nature of the universe is wide open, but it's testable by not doing very much. We simply have to study life on our own planet a little bit more closely, and we might answer that question which everybody would like to know. Do we live in a bio-friendly universe?
You're listening to Paul Davies of Arizona State University, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Davies is a cosmologist, theoretical physicist, and astrobiologist. At a science meeting, he spoke more about the search for life beyond Earth with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
So tell us about the latest on scientists' search for alien life, something that you've described as life as we don't yet know it. What's happening here?
We're all used to the idea of life on other worlds and think of this as alien life, as having a separate origin, as being weird, different from us, not only what it looks like, but also its biochemistry. A lot of thought's been given to, well, if we find life on Mars or Europa, what will we look for? It could be completely different from nucleic acid and protein life that we find here on Earth. But this assumes that life is going to form readily in Earth-like conditions all around the universe. So there is that general assumption which underpins the whole of the subject of astrobiology, that life is easy to make and widespread. But we don't know that. It could be that it is a stupendously incredible freak. It could be that life is just confined to Earth. It's happened only once and we're it. So how can we discriminate between these two different extremes? Well, one way is to look for whether life has happened many times on Earth. There's no planet more Earth-like than Earth itself. So if life does emerge readily in Earth-like conditions, it should have happened many times over right here on our home planet. And then the next question is, how do we know it didn't? Has anybody actually looked? Most life on Earth is microbial. Most microbes haven't been characterized, let alone had their genes sequenced. So it's entirely possible that in that microbial realm is what we like to call a shadow biosphere. It doesn't mean that it's sort of shadowy in the mystical sense. It just means that we don't yet know what it is. We don't recognize it for what it is. We could be dealing just with ordinary-looking microbes, but with their innards completely different. They could have a different organization inside. They could have different biochemistry. And we wouldn't know that because the techniques that biochemists and microbiologists use to study life is customized to life that we know. So it simply doesn't work with life that we don't know. So we have no idea what's out there. 99.99% of microbial species are still unknown, and it could well be in our environment that there are microbes with radically different biochemistry that would suggest they're descended from a different origin. Life may have started 58 times on Earth, and we could have 27 shadow biospheres descended from those different geneses, and only one of these achieved multicellular life, and we're the product of that, but we can't rule out the possibility that the others are still out there somewhere.
Where on Earth are scientists, astrobiologists, looking for how life may have evolved?
So there's been a lot of research on the setting in which life on Earth may have begun, and there are various fashions, but one of these is that it might have started hot and deep. My own opinion, for what it's worth, is that it may well have started 1 or 2 kilometres beneath the seabed near one of the volcanic vents that are so common, where the internal heat of the Earth comes up and meets the ocean and creates thermal pandemonium, and there's a lot of cycling of water and minerals and so on. I think that offers a possible setting, so that life may have begun in this in what we might call hell, deep down under the ground, and then only later evolved and adapted to cooler surface conditions on Earth. But it could be this is totally wrong. It may be that life didn't even start on Earth. It may have started in space. It may have started, in fact, in very cold conditions, been delivered to Earth in micrometeorites or comet impacts or something of that sort, and then established itself on Earth and evolved spread to the deep, hot subsurface. And then it may be that during the heavy early bombardment of the Earth, when the surface of the Earth was sterilized by enormous impacts, only the things that lived deep underground in the hot temperatures got through that genetic bottleneck. And so it could well be that the descendants of life on Earth now are descended from these few organisms that survived that impact. But the origin of life, we have no idea. It could have been somewhere else entirely. So people have looked in settings they have conjectured about settings as diverse as raindrops and drying lagoons and deep subsurface pores of rocks, or on Mars. It's entirely likely life began on Mars and came later to Earth. Mars was actually a more favorable planet for life to get going in the early history of the solar system. So again, I think we don't have to be restricted to Earth. But wherever it started, what we're interested in is, did it start more than once? And how can we best test that? It seems to me that the best way is looking for multiple forms of life right here on Earth.
What's the most likely form that life might be like on other worlds?
Oh, I think microbial life is easy to imagine. In fact, I think there's a good chance there's microbial life on Mars, possibly also on Europa. Microbes can survive under a much wider range of conditions than multicellular life. So I don't think anybody expects to go to Mars and find cats and dogs walking around, but there's still a good chance that there's microbial life in the deep subsurface. And so the same thing here on Earth. We're not talking about multicellular alien or weird or shadow life, because we would already have noticed if there was there were large things which were not our form of life, they would have been studied. But because the microbial realm is so little studied, there's every possibility that some of its inhabitants are descendants of a second or subsequent genesis.
What is the most important thing that you'd like the public today to know about the search for alien life?
Well, if we're talking about the search for alien life on Earth specifically and not searching the whole universe, I think the most important thing that they should know is that the question about whether life is a freak accident or built into the nature of the universe is wide open, but it's testable by not doing very much. We simply have to study life on our own planet a little bit more closely, and we might answer that question which everybody would like to know. Do we live in a bio-friendly universe? I'd like to believe we do, but at this stage, we can't be sure. It could be that we are freaks in a cold, hostile, friendless universe, but it could be that life is built into the fundamental nature of things, and that would be much more congenial in my view.
You've been listening to Paul Davies, director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science at Arizona State University. To subscribe to this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The European Space Agency is developing a satellite called FORUM, F-O-R-U-M. It will measure previously unobserved far infrared radiation emitted by the Earth with a wavelength of 15.5 micrometers. This is significant because the Earth's peak energetic emission is in the far infrared. About half of Earth's outgoing long-wave radiance is far infrared. It makes a dominant contribution to clear sky atmospheric radiative cooling. This, in turn, is a key driver of atmospheric dynamics. It is also the radiation that gets trapped by molecules such as carbon dioxide and methane, the culprits causing the greenhouse effect. Well, this has been The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie. Hopefully, we'll be back next Wednesday at 7 o'clock.